welcome back to Railway Mania. Today I am here with Will, Matt, Nathan from the Swanage Railway Trust. We're here to talk about the London and South Western Railway T3 locomotive. So if everyone could just go around the room and introduce yourselves.
Yes, I'm Matthew McManus. I'm a member of the 563 Locomotive Group.
Hi, my name's Will Armstead-Sherrett. I am a trustee at the Swanage Railway and I represent the 563 Locomotive Group on the Swanage Railway Trust board.
My name's Nathan Now. I'm the chair of the 563 Locomotive Group.
For anybody who's not got a background in Southern Railway locomotives and constituents, what is the T3?
The T3 is a London and South Western Railway 440 express passenger engine built in 1893 at Nine Elms Works in London.
Initially based at Nine Elms Shed, moved to Guildford in 1905 and then was heavily rebuilt in 1906. Then it spent about 20 years based between Eastleigh and Guildford before becoming part of the Southern Railway in grouping in 1923. Then it led a pretty quiet life until 1935 when it was overhauled, interestingly, after a lot of the class had already been withdrawn. It then was moved to Salisbury where it was used on slow passenger trains between Salisbury and Bournemouth before moving back to Eastleigh in 1938. At Eastleigh, it failed on a forwarded goods train in March 1939 where it was withdrawn, seemingly marking the end of the locomotive's existence. Obviously, the political situation intervened, and with the advent of war in November 1939, it was overhauled back into service. It then was based between Basingstoke and Eastleigh, hauling van trains, and interestingly recorded hauling a rake of 10 teak coaches during the Dunkirk evacuation in 1940. In 1942, it went back to Eastleigh for another overhaul, and then was used as the station shed pilot. With the end of the war in 1945, it was withdrawn. Seemingly, that was going to be the end of...
So it kind of got a stay of execution because of the war?
Multiple stays. It got a stay of execution, you could say, in 1935, when it was overhauled after lots of the class had already been withdrawn, and then again, yeah.
And by this time, was it the lone survivor?
So by this point, there were two. You had 571, which was withdrawn in 1943, and 563 that lasted until 1945. But there were also a number of other X2 and X6 class locomotives that lasted throughout the war, and then after the end of the war, they ended up in Eastleigh Works.
So these are all a sort of similar era of locos?
Yeah, similar era, all built by Adams. Some have got slightly bigger driving wheels. The T3, I think, by a lot of the railway press, was regarded as the best, and the basis for the later ones, but they're all quite similar. One of the interesting things that's come to light through our research is that when we've been trying to actually understand how 563 has been preserved, a lot of the books written about it state that it was just preserved because of Waterloo 100. That obviously took place in May 1948.
Meeting of British Railways realised that the Waterloo centenary was coming up, and so A.B. MacLeod and other senior Southern Railway directors arranged a visit to look at all these Adams 440 engines at Kimbridge Junction with a view to cosmetically restoring one so that it could attend the Waterloo 100 celebration.
One of the really interesting things we found out actually is that there was obviously a much longer running campaign or effort by groups such as the Stevenson's Locomotive Society to save an Adams 440. We actually cottoned onto this because the locomotive's record card said that it was transferred into their ownership. So I made contact with them. I thought, that's unusual. Haven't read that anywhere. Did that actually happen? I made contact with them and they pointed out an editorial piece in their 1948 journal, which said basically how good it was that thanks to their negotiations with Bullitt, one of the Adams 440 class had been preserved. When I went to the archives, I had a look through the whole year of the Stevenson's Locomotive Society. And interestingly, actually, in their May one, it talks about, they've got an article about locomotive preservation, writing about how they were working with the railway executive to preserve an Adams 440 prior to nationalisation in negotiations to purchase 571. They met with Riddles, famous for designing the standard class locomotives, and a number of other people, and they were trying to persuade them
to keep one of these quintessential 440 locomotives. As I said, yeah, interestingly, it was 571 that they were negotiating to purchase.
Right.
Obviously, also in May 1948, McLeod goes to visit the 440s, 563, 571, and all the other X2 and X6s at Albridge Sidings.
But if they had their eyes on 571, then why are we talking about the 563 locomotive today and not 571?
Well, we can't be absolutely sure. I think, unfortunately, lots of the paperwork that probably give you the definitive answer of that has been lost in history. But I think the best hypothesis I've come across is I found a photo of 571 in the Eastleigh dump in 1947. These front buffer beams all caved in. Looks like it's had a rough shunt. Running plates all a bit warped at the front. While that's not something that is mission critical or is irredeemable, you know, it's just metalwork. Obviously, if you're going
to... I suppose if you've got a choice of two, you want the one that's the least amount of effort.
If you're just doing cosmetic display, you would obviously choose the locomotive that didn't have the bent buffer beam. Yeah, very nearly the 571 locomotive group, I guess. Doesn't have quite the same ring to it, though, but
563 was lucky enough to be saved, and then it went in May 1948 to Eastleigh, where it was overhauled in 20 days before going up under light steam, limited to 25 miles an hour.
So it was overhauled to working condition, it wasn't just a cosmetic overhaul?
Well, it was restored, it was obviously in working condition at the point of withdrawal.
But then it was sitting around for 2 years, I guess.
From what we think, they didn't do a full mechanical overhaul, but patched the boiler up sufficient that it could run, at a reduced pressure of 60 pounds per square inch, so that's not a lot.
So enough to move itself around, but...
It moved itself in one coach at 25 miles an hour, and it went from Eastleigh to Waterloo, and then we think it wasn't steamed again. And then after that, it was stored at the Fair and Carriage Sidings, being displayed at various open days that Eastleigh works. Gradually, its condition deteriorated, and it was decided it needed to be stored somewhere better. So it went to Brighton for preparatory work to be sent to Tweedmouth, where it went in 1958 with Box Hill and the South East Chatham Railway D-Class 440.
And by that point, I guess that the preservation movement had started getting going. So we already had a few preserved lines, and there was a lot more focus on saving some of these things. Because what's quite unusual is that it was one of those early survivors. It didn't really work a great deal in British Railways ownership. Most of the locos that we have in preservation, I mean, they had to get past, say, 1955 to be withdrawn and to actually be saved. There's so many that got culled before that. And most of the locos that got, you know, withdrawn before nationalisation never made it out. And there wasn't really a private preservation movement as such then.
Yeah, I think you hit on an interesting point in that lots of people look at the start of preservation as 1951 for the Talclyn or 1958 for the Bluebell Railway. But actually, like, if you look at the history of locomotive preservation, it's a lot longer history. You know, Rocket was preserved. There's a whole plethora of really old engines, like the Aerolite.
But I guess not on the same scale. That's the tragedy that we'd have so few survivors from the Victorian era because of that.
Absolutely. But yeah, I think that does make it quite interesting. And you think, well, one of the things I've been looking at since joining the group is how was it safe? Why was it safe? Why did it hang around for 4 years outside Eastleigh Works? Why wasn't it scrapped immediately? You know, it's the fourth Southern Region engine to be preserved. You know, you've got the Canterbury Witch, which is, what was an 1840s engine. Then you've got Gladstone, which was moved to York in the late 20s, but preserved by the Stevenson's Locomotive Society. Then you've got Box Hill, that was the work shunter at Brighton, saved in 1946. There were obviously attempts to save other engines. You had Ride from the Isle of Wight, which was unfortunately scrapped in 1940 because the Railway Correspondence and Travel Society couldn't afford the £50 to preserve it in 1933. Yeah, there's a whole, but yeah, it's the fourth engine.
And when we get into the 1960s with it, do you think at that point its future is secured? Is it a bit of a treasure by then, or is it still under threat?
I think once it was saved in 1948, it was sort of going to be saved. From some of the archival research we've done, there's references in an Eastleigh withdrawal book of an Eastleigh museum. There's not much information about that. We think that in actual fact that refers to the pre-war museum. But obviously there was desires to save these old engines. Like I said, you had Ride, you had the Drummondburg, and there was an old London Southwestern Railway saddle tank. And those were all lost because of the war. After the war, there was obviously a clear desire from people to save the engine, and Waterloo 100 was a great excuse for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think once after Waterloo 100, it just sort of it rolled around the network, but it was already regarded as a preserved item.
Marvellous. And so what happens after that?
Well, so after it goes to Tweedmouth in 1958, it comes back to Eastleigh to be restored again. That's a much more comprehensive restoration. Returned it completely to as-built condition. Then it went by road from there to the Clapham Museum. And then in 1975, it was moved by rail to the National Railway Museum. Then it basically settled into a pretty quiet life. It was on the turntable. I remember going to see it when I was about 10, and it was on the turntable in the Great Hall. And then it moved to Shildon. And then in 2011, it obviously went to Canada as part of...
Well, tell me about that, because some people might not have heard about its trip to Canada.
Well, I'm not quite sure about exact dates, but it wasn't really doing too much, really. It was just on display with their children. And the Canadians were running a show called Railway Children, and they were looking for an old-fashioned looking engine. And so they decided to approach the National Rail Museum to borrow the engine. And the National Rail Museum kind of thought about it quite intensely, because the engine had been sort of sitting in the shadows for years and years and years. They decided that it would be good to bring it out and let people, a new audience, to see it, not just to be in a show, but to be actually out there. And so the engine went off to Canada, in Toronto, and was in a show in the Railway Children, and it ran very successfully on the show. It was called in and out.
So was that fulfilling the role of what they call the Green Dragon? That's in right. The
book? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it was part of the stage show, and the group who were looking after it there did a good job of it, and then the engine came back on a ship again back to England. And then the engine was put into the theatre show to join the Railway Children in London at King's Cross, outside the Google development at the moment. And so that was...
So how does that work then? Because obviously it can't move under its own steam.
No, so what they do is it's basically a theatre prop, and they use it as such. They specially made a little sort of electric shunter that you could kind of drive it with an electronic thing, and you just pushed it in and out. And it went in and out the shed every night, 4 or 5 times a year for 2 or 3 years.
So this is like a 1-to-1 scale motor bogey,
in essence.
Yeah, but it's behind the stage, so it's like it's not out in the stage. So it was pushed out of the stage into the theatre with a coach, and then the little electric like tug thing pulled it back there and back and there and back. And you know, it was all good, and it went very well, and we raised a lot of money for obviously the theatre company. And the NRM got a lot of money out of it as well as their project.
So, Matt, can you tell me about what happened during its stay at King's Cross? So it's involved in the theatre production. Were there any plans to do anything with it after that?
At the time, Swanage Railway wasn't involved in any discussion with the National Rail Museum. It was a cooperation between the theatre company and the National Rail Museum. Previously, though, a few years prior to this all kicking off, I was the deputy operations manager at a railway, and we were having a bit of a change of heart with regards to our motive power situation, and we'd sent our engineers up to York, and we'd looked at the Bully Q1 that had been at the Bluebell for many years, but when we were interested in having that engine at Swanage and overhauling it and running it on the railway. But the Flying Scotsman overhaul at the time was going through an incredibly rough patch, and the National Rail Museum said, look, we have to focus on that, we must get that finished. And they broke off discussions with us on very good terms about the Bully Q1. And so we just said thanks very much, and we left it at that, and we just kept in contact quite quietly, really. So anyway, I was actually on holiday in Turkey, and we got an email from Anthony Cools with regards to 563, and he said that we might well be interested in having 563. And we committed at that point to having all the John Bunch moguls at the railway. And so I said, oh, I could put it to the trust, but I don't think so, because obviously we're very committed at Swanage, and we've got, you know, a lot on our plate. And it became quite apparent quite quickly that they weren't actually offering a loan, they were offering a ownership transfer.
But because this is quite unusual, I guess, for a lot of people, because there's been a lot of instances of items in the National Collection being restored with either private owners' money or funds and things like that, and restored to run again. So, like, the LNWR 080 is an example of that. But this is different, because this is actually transferring ownership of the loco to a society.
Yes, it's not something that they do very often. It's not something they do without a great deal of thought. We were surprised. Obviously, we weren't expecting it. We didn't seek it. It wasn't something that we'd gone out and suggested, or anything. We knew that they'd even do it.
And what does deaccessioning mean? Is that like trying to find a loving home for something, or does it like, for some people it might seem a bit like trying to sell off items, but how does it work?
Deaccessioning isn't selling. You don't buy something from a national museum. It's not like that. Deaccessioning essentially means that you are transferring ownership and responsibility to establish your organization that can take it forward or do something different with it. Having an ownership means that you have a lot more freedom in how you manage an item. It's the difference between the T9 and the T3. The T9 is under a loan agreement with the railway, and it has very strict rules about how we look after it, how we can repair it, how we can do other things, which we are going to be working through over the next 12 months with the T9. With the T3, as owners, we can do what we like with it. It becomes private property.
Does it speed up decision making in that way?
Totally, yes. You don't need to, as owners, it's like, in theory, we could paint it pink with blue, pink spots, you know, it's just, we could do whatever we want.
Although we don't currently have any plans to do that.
The rumour starts here. You heard it.
What I'm trying to say is that not that we're going to do that, but deaccessioning essentially means that you are transferring an asset from a national collection into private hands. And it's done for a number of reasons, but in our case, it was done because at the time, the National Royal Museum were reviewing a lot of their collection, and they found that they had certain engines that were duplicated with regards to wheel arrangement or region, and that included our engine, 563, the Great Western 280 heavy freight engine. But it wasn't just a simple, this is for you, this is, you know, you have it. We had to prove to the NRM that we were suitable custodians to it. I took all the information I needed from the NRM, and we took it to the Swanage Railway Trust, and we presented, and we had a lot of debate about it, because obviously the Swanage Railway never has owned an engine in its current format, so we needed to make sure that we wanted it, and it did meet all of our tactical needs from not just a motive power point of view, but from a historical point of view, that it's in our constitution that we acquire Southern engines and LSWR design. So it is, that ticks that box. And that was really what we needed to focus on. So obviously the trust voted for it. We're very democratic at Swanage. We vote on everything. And we started to build it and put contracts together. And particularly what was important was that we included a clause if the Swanage Railway ever folded or we ran into financial difficulties or anything like that, that the NRM would be handed the engine back.
So the future of the locomotive is secured no matter what?
Yeah, well, totally, yes. It's if the Swanage Railway folds, or if it becomes a different organisation, in so much as if it becomes, say, if the Swanage Railway Trust eventually folds like the Southern Steam Trust, the engine just rotates into the next charitable being that the railway becomes. So it's one of the reasons why the engine stays in the Swanage Railway Trust, not in a company. As the 563 stays in the trust, it's under charitable law. It's protected as a historical asset.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've seen what happened with Llangollen recently and the company going into the hands of receivers and the company assets being, you know, broken up to pay the creditors and everything. So obviously you don't want something like that to happen. So you would want to put it in the hands of the trust. And I guess from the National Railway Museum's point of view, it's quite difficult because you might have a finite amount of space, but history marches on, and you can't just say with the National Railway Museum, but we're only going to preserve things up to 2000. It's like, well, you've got to represent things from the whole history of railways, and that's in their mandate. So they're constantly going to have things added to it, and so they're going to have to make quite difficult decisions about what to keep on display.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, it was a decision that they had to arrive at. They had four 440 express passenger engines of around the same era. They weren't in, F563 was arguably the quietest one of those four. It didn't really shout. It was moving around all the time. It wasn't particularly important to the collection in that respect. It didn't tell us its own unique story. Whereas us at Swanage, our earliest engine is the M7, which obviously ran all the way through to the 1960s. 1963, I think, the last one ran in the Swanage branch. We don't have, at Swanage, an ability to tell the story pre-BR or pre-Southern Railway. So we, you know, even if we hired the BT Whale tanks from Bodmin, they're all in BR condition. 563 allows us to tell a story at Swanage that we've not been able to tell before. So this is really great. So why the NRM can tell that story all day long, we've never been able to. It is now owned by a group of members, which anyone could become part of if they had that passion for the railway. Anyone could be a Swanage Railway Trust member. And as that, you are by default a member and owner of the engine. So it's not really changing. It's just...
And what's brilliant is the ability to present the locomotive in context as well. So it's in the correct region. You know, it's operating from stations that were built by the same company or operated by the same company. So you're able to present it not just in action, which you can't do with a museum piece. And, you know, that's an ongoing conversation about what preservation is and preserving techniques versus preserving objects. But, you know, I don't think there's any firm conclusion on that. But I think what is quite special is the ability to preserve things in context like that and to tell a story. It's another part of the storytelling process.
You have to remember that when we acquired, or we were going through the process of acquiring 563, the NRM didn't mind what we were doing for it. It didn't mind whether we had any particular plans for it. It didn't really care. What it cared about was that it moved it on into a suitable organization. And during the process of acquiring the engine, we didn't talk about making it run again. It wasn't part of the agenda. It wasn't something that we were going to complicate the process with. And so obviously, when it arrived, it sat outside for 6 months. But we were all always thinking that, you know, the railway took this very pragmatic view, is that we don't have an undercover accommodation for it. We need to sort that problem out. So we have a few options. We can either make it steam, or we can build a shed, or we can send it away. And it's still our property. We just need to make sure that we look after it. And the rest of the team worked together to formulate a plan and get the engine off to the flour mill, and then we persuaded the trust to commit to overhauling it. You know, they're all stepping stones. I think from my point of view, because I was involved in day one of these negotiations when we got it, in my head, we were always going to run it. But it's not what you had to focus on. Although in my head, I think, well, we're not going to acquire this without making it run. But it's just, you don't talk about that sort of stuff when you're trying to get something.
Well, also, you don't want to make promises to anybody about what you're going to do with it and then find out for whatever reason that that's not possible anymore. So say if the whole engine had been completely shot, then that, you know, you'd basically be renewing the entire thing. It would have been not a great move to have then before that promised that it would run again.
Yeah, I mean, the Bluebell have a very similar problem with the Adams radio, which is that it needs a new boiler, it needs new wheels. I couldn't tell you the list of problems, but...
Yeah, and at what point are you just replacing everything behind the works plate?
I mean, we knew. So myself, Kevin Potts and Graham Farrow went to the King's Cross Theatre to look at 563. And when we saw it for the first time, there was not a doubt in my mind, or Graham's mind, and Graham's the expert, that it was something that we could make run again. Because it was just astonishing. It had no corrosion. It had no visible signs that it had been working. Everything was immaculate. It had no play in it. It was really bizarre because it just looked like it had an overhauled chassis with the world's worst boiler put on it. It was a really odd thing to look at.
So what happened after it arrived at the Swanage then?
So the engine arrived in 2017, obviously off the back of a lorry straight from King's Cross. The trouble is at Swanage we don't have as much space as other railways, unfortunately. So we opted to...
Well, a very pretty engine shed, but a very small one.
I know, it's a shame. It's a perfect environment for it, but we didn't have any firm plans at the moment for it. So we actually thought the best place that we could keep it on display for the time being, whilst we sort of formulated what to do with the engine, is we take it actually to Corfe Castle. We've got the good shed there, and there's the LSWR book wagon, so that was quite appropriate. But also in the cattle dock area, it means actually people could walk up to the engine, have a look around it at least, and it was on display. We only needed the summer to do that, so the weather was fair, and we could actually, you know, keep it in the public view. What we didn't want to do is to arrive on the railway, disappear into a void, you know, and sort of maybe then just lost, or what are we going to do with it next? So we just needed to bide our time so we could actually, you know, I think Matt and I, we sort of already had the ambition, the intent was we were always going to try and return it to steam. You know, our engineer, Graham, he'd already looked at it. And apart from obviously the firebox with the patching, fundamentally he believed there was, you know, a working engine in there, and we that gave us the confidence with that initial inspection.
And was that always the intention?
Yeah, I think once Matt and Graham had been up to King's Cross to have a look at it, you have that gut feeling. And, you know, Graham's one of our top engineers. He's our locomotive superintendent. You know, what he sees fit, you know, in his eyes, we fully support. And with that sort of feeling and the impression that it gave to Matt and him at the time, certainly Matt's belief, you know, we need to get this steaming. So the intention was always there. We just had to, usual politics, we had to make sure we had some kind of plan, actually sit down and devise the schedule, you know, how we're actually going to do this. You know, we don't have the facilities of our own boiler works, etc. So we needed it to go somewhere as well, but we just needed a bit of time. So we had it on display.
But I think that's really important, because too often, I think, and it happens everywhere, people want to get stuck in quickly. So they start taking bits off to paint them, or, you know, stick a coat of red oxide on it or whatever.
Yeah.
And then things start to go missing. It's the same with, you know, anybody who's done a classic car will know this. As soon as you start taking that car apart, that car will take up five times the amount of room. Yes. And then things get put into storage. Someone says, oh, I'll take that home and I'll clean that up. And then, you know, they're ill or whatever, that doesn't come back and no one remembers where everything is. So you have to have that plan in place before you take anything apart.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's it. So we didn't need long, we just needed a few months to get it together. You know, we also knew we didn't want to leave it out there for a winter. You know, even you know, especially down on the south by the sea, we didn't want to expose it unnecessarily without having done anything to the bodywork. So put the plan together with the unknowns. We did want to sort of take it step by step. And the first sort of easy step to do was a feasibility study. But to do that, we needed to go somewhere. Now, as it turns out, the flour mill had the sort of scope to do this strip down. They have the space, important.
And this is the flour mill that's based in Forest of Dean?
Forest of Dean, Lydney, yeah. So yeah, and they've also got the experience of engines that's sort of similar vintage. They did the T9 before us, they've done BT Wells, they've done Met 1s, you know, it's the right skills and expertise there. And as I say, they had the space to take the engine in, and also they were quite willing to work with us, you know, understanding that, you know, we would need to, the strip down would be a long, lengthy process with no guarantee of, you know, an overhaul an option at the end of that process.
And what records did you have of the work that was done by BR before? Is there anything, or was it just sort of done as a matter of course and no records survived?
Well, so there's good records from the 1960 restoration, although probably more, but the most of the records that we have are from the scoping work rather than the work that was actually carried out. But a lot of that is related to returning like pipework to its original location, fitting a splasher on the front bogey.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, it's not this bearing, we're going to replace that as new. So there was, even though we've got the information related to the work and the scope of the work that was carried out in the last overhaul it had, which was only for cosmetic display, it was in 1960, there are still lots of sort of, you know, unknowns. You sort of think, well...
And are these things like, you know, changes in materials such as asbestos lagging and that kind of thing that need to be handled with care?
There was a degree of asbestos lagging on the engine that we've with the flour mill, we've sort of worked through that issue, so we don't have any more asbestos on there now. It's been safely disposed of, so now we're going to be using more modern lagging materials going forward, so yeah, it should be pretty good. But it gets rid of a big problem for us, because obviously we don't use that sort of material now.
Yeah, I mean, financially, it's a huge killer for so many groups just to remove that horrible stuff, which was the miracle material back in the day, but now we recognise the dangers of it.
Absolutely. You have to just be very careful with it. It's not as quite as terrible as people think to get rid of it. It certainly is expensive, but it's not by any means a project will kill it. A killer is just one of those things. We'll get through it, and we have got through it. So now we're just sort of... waiting for the modern materials to go in.
Well, we obviously knew that it was withdrawn in March 1939 on a full goods train. It failed, and then it didn't really have any major overhaul since that. And the key area of concern was the inner firebox, because that's why it had to run at a reduced pressure to Waterloo 100. The firebox had been extensively patched. Yeah, there was still a lot of unknowns, because although we had the sort of general spec, you know, they were only restoring it for a museum. You know, you don't know if they're going to worry about any of the bearings and
clearance.
And I guess it's wartime service. The reduced maintenance schedules that you had during that time means it would probably run into the ground during that period. So it's not like it had an easy time in the war.
When the engine was running during the war and everything like that, obviously maintenance was lower down on the importance during the time. But the engine was still running reliably. But when we get to the point when we want to use it nowadays, you know, we have to sort of say, this engine is now not suitable for use now. And so then we have to make sure that we have to make the boiler that is not only safe. It's not just nowadays, we want reliability. We want it to be safe. And we're using it for a different reason. I mean, when it was running during the war, it's obviously... Its reason for running is to keep the war effort going. At the time, any railway company were basically getting locomotives to run during the war, and you know, maintenance was less than you know what it would have more normally been. That's how, I mean, it's really the reason why the engine survived.
Well, there are quite a few interesting survivors from that period. So there were lots that were sort of taken off the scrap lines and put back into service. Sort of had that same stay of execution for quite a lot of older classes that would have otherwise vanished by that point.
It's definitely not something that was unique to the southern region. Lots of once World War II kicked off, it was something that that every company it was one of those things that all of them had to sort of go through in order to keep the war effort going. 563 was just one of those engines that ended up part of it. At the time, it was just another engine working, keeping going. And it's just a coincidence that we are in the position we are in now. There wasn't anything particularly special about 563 at the time. It was doing a job and it needed to keep running.
Well, let's hope it continues to be lucky.
Well, we have definitely been very lucky, I think. And that's the thing. It was a bit between the end of the war and then up to now. You know, there's what period of, 60, 70 years. It's been a bit of an unknown. This is why it was so crucial that we sort of tread cautiously, go through the feasibility study, actually disassemble the engine, you know, start to turn over these stones and see what we've got. And as it happens, yeah, we were really lucky because, as Will said, although the scope was there for the overhaul, what we've actually found is actually a very well overhauled bottom end on the engine.
Oh, brilliant.
It's just the boiler that they patched. And we get that because it's a very novel patch repair and quite ingenious by Easley, really, actually, for the it did the job. But it would never have, it's not something that we've ever seen before. And that's why we've decided to save the whole firebox in its entirety, just to demonstrate some of the engineering skills in the plate. You know, the plate and patchwork that they did to get
fighters. Well, I think there's a lot of that at the moment where there's a lot of talk about preserving things in which condition do you choose and what do you incorporate? So, for example, do you fix a bit of damage or is that damage part of the loco's history? And likewise, some locos you get to the point where to fix it would basically mean constructing an entirely new engine. What you're also trying to preserve at the same time, like with this firebox, is showing the techniques used by people in that time to mend a problem that they had.
Well, I think you have to be pragmatic with overhauling an engine like this. We have to be clear that we need to create an engine that is reliable, that's going to give us a good return on our investment. We are spending upwards of £400,000 on this engine. However, we have to also sort of temper that every time in the fact that we've got this engine from the National Rail Museum. We can't just change it in every way that we want. It will have a finite time of running. We have to decide, you know, how long it will run, where we go, what we change. 563 has had a tough life up until this point. And we have to sort of decide: do we want to get the engine to run every day of the year, or do we want it to run 50 times a year, or 10?
And how do you get it to repay that investment as well? So how do you make it pay for the next overhaul, and what's the right balance to strike between wear and tear in using it? Because every time you use it, obviously you add to the cost of the next overhaul.
It's difficult to say. You don't generally overhaul steam engines looking for a clear return on your investment. And sometimes if we worried about what was going on in 10 years' time, rather than what's happening now, you know, we might never get off the ground. We have to take the first step. And so we have to get through this overhaul now, get the engine running, get the engine reliably running. And then after that, we need to then plan where we go next. And it doesn't mean that the engine will be the be all and end all. It might be that the T3 is a catalyst for other things, overhaul project. It might involve coaches and T9, all this sort of stuff in the future might well go in. So what we are seeing is that 563 isn't just, it won't stand in isolation, but we also need to be flexible enough that we can do lots of other things with the engine. And that might mean that we just run it again in 10 years' time, or it might mean that we might take a break and the engine will have a rest for a few years while we do something else, you know. So it just depends. Although we might worry about where the next overhaul money's coming from, we haven't even started the first one.
What are the jobs that have been done to date at the flour mill?
Okay, so we've had a large mechanical strip down prior to us agreeing to the overhaul of the engine, which is just to establish its restorable condition, checking tolerances between drawings and what's actually on the engine. There are certain things that are stuff from its modification into sort of a showroom condition rather than an operating condition. So we've had to sort of assess whether we're going to keep certain things. Things like the piston tail rods that Nathan mentioned earlier, they are modifications for display purposes, but they are, on reflection, fully working. But we've only discovered that through the operation of the strip down of the loco. The old patched firebox has been painstakingly withdrawn from the firebox. The outer firebox is now a display item. The brand new copper firebox has been formed, riveted together, is now being drilled. We've got four very expensive girder stays that are that sit on top of the firebox that have been completely replaced. A new lubrication system, because the engine actually had a dummy lubrication system based on its old 1902 condition. We've had to require a hydrostatic lubricator that will be reliable enough for the engine. We've had to change all the rubbers, put them all back in. We're currently about to start on a new smoke box. Shot blasted, painted the equalizing beams. We were going to change them and go for the more traditional style of suspension, but we can't find a drawing for it, and we're running about a little bit low on time. So what we're actually going to do is going to permanently fix the equalising beams to the frames, because although it had them when we acquired them, it was clearly just something that Eastley had just chucked on to kind of make it look right. So we had loose rivets, things like that. Eventually, we do kind of intend to maybe get rid of that, but we'll have to create a drawing for it and CAD it all up before we actually make it for real. But it's just a time issue now, you know, to change it to a full suspension system as we kind of want it to be. You know, we're talking £10,000. It's not necessary. We need to get the move on. So we're going to go with the equalising beams for now.
What was up with the smoke box? Was it completely wasted?
It's a perishable item. Although obviously we talk about smoke boxes as a big item, ticket item, they generally only last 10 years. They can be patched, obviously. And some locos get longer than 10 years out of their smoke boxes and ash pans. But generally speaking, ash pan smoke box is a 10-year thing, and we get rid of them and start again. And that's what we're doing with 563. It's not particularly in terrible condition, but if we were to make it run again with the one it's got now, you know, we might get a couple of years use out of it, and then we're having to change it. So we really do need to just get rid of it now and start again.
Because of the way it's been removed from the tube plate, I think you'd need to replace quite a lot of it anyway, so we might as well do the whole thing.
Its attachment to the barrel is not simplistic. So like Will said, it's quite difficult to put on and off. Yeah. So basically, the engine's at the point now where it's resting on frame stands. The axle boxes are being done at the moment, and we're going to hopefully wheel it within the next sort of 2 or 3 months, and then we're going to be thinking about hanging all the motion, doing the lubrication lines, fitting the cab, again eventually getting the boiler done. And bolt and put into the frames, and then obviously we've got pipe work, lagging, all that sort of stuff. You know, we're not on the home stretch, but we are over the hump. We're on our way.
One of the other most controversial bits of a restoration is also the paint.
Well, I assume you're going to be painting it blue with red stripes.
Yeah, like Edward. No, we're.
I mean, are you prepared for all the kids to point at it and say that's Edward?
Yeah, I think we probably are. But yeah, we have. Well, the flour mill have tentatively started painting some bits of it in its top coat, which is the Drummond era livery as it was turned out in 1948. So as Matt said, although it's not on home straight, you know, start seeing it coming out in that colour is going to hopefully, you know, whet the appetites of our supporters and others, you know.
And how was that done? Was that taken from samples of the paint job that was
so ironed? That was a bit of a, well, it was, as preserved, it was originally painted in Drummond era livery when it was preserved in 1948, and then in the 1960 restoration it was repainted into Adams pea green, which is a different colour. We're going to do it up as it in the paint scheme as roughly as it was in 1948, although we're not sure that that paint colour was quite right. It's quite hard to tell because of colour film, etc., you know, the variation.
Is there anything that you can take a swatch from?
It'd been quite a conundrum, and I visited the archives at the National Railway Museum earlier this year, and having another look through a lot of 563's files, and I'd booked a train because of social distancing, had to book a train that had an hour or so free, and I was like, I'll just have a look through the M7 that they've got, which is 245, and I was like, I'll just have a look through there, see if there's anything interesting. And that was repainted in 2001, and so luckily there was a note from Tony Philby from the National Railway Museum paint studio that wrote this side of A4, because basically they'd painted it the wrong colour when they restored it, I think, for the Woking 100. And so he wrote this thing about how they'd ascertained the right colour. And he talks about all the tribulations of that, because there was this brilliant quote from Adams or Drummond at the time about the person who actually mixed the paint at 9 ounces wasn't very consistent and he resigned. And so this Tony concluded that it was described as a green like young grass in spring, that's the quote, we're bordered with purple brown and a double white line and a black insert. Obviously, what does a green like young grass in spring look like? That's a bit subjective. But anyway, he thought that no two engines would be the same colour anyway, but they concluded that it was, the colour is very similar to a modern colour, which is BS-225 light Brunswick green. And that's what 245's been painted. Nobody seems to have complained about that. And so we've compared that with a few samples from Precision Paints and various other sources, and we think that's the best bet to go with, you know.
Well, because I think you're talking about something that's not just out of living memory for the originals, it's out of the range of colour film. So it's, you know, from the black and white era.
Yeah, you've got different pigments as well. You know, if you, there's, and obviously, yeah, the restoration in 1948, you think that, well, actually, you think probably someone would have been alive that remembers it. But then you look at various pictures and you think, well, that's completely different to that one. So to play on the safe side, I think we've said we'll go with the livery that the M7 at the National Railway Museum's painted. No one's complained about that. And so hopefully no one will complain about.
And it looks great. That's the trouble. You get the colour swatches, and until you actually paint it on a big area and you see, you know, you see it out in the sun, you don't know what it looks like. So yeah, whilst you could sort of take the small, you know, 1-inch sort of swatches and think, is that going to look right? Actually, someone's already tried this for us, so we've got a bit more confidence. So yeah, seeing 563 in the same sort of in the same livery will be lovely. Maybe seeing the two of them together, even better. That'll be
well, that's going to be my question. Are you going to ask to borrow the M7 as well?
Yeah, we can. It can go back to York, or we can borrow.
It's definitely worth exploring. Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, I think that brings us neatly back to the current overhaul. So, what's the timeline for completion on that? So, what are the jobs that you recognise that you have to do now? Obviously, the firebox and the boiler is a big issue, but what sort of timescales are we looking at for that?
If the money's forthcoming, then we're saying that the ambition is to have the T3 for 2023, which, in the grand scheme of things, when you consider when we acquired the engine just 5 years ago, to then actually getting the engine overhauled 7-8 years later, is remarkable. The fact that we've been able to turn around the engine as quick as we have been has only been thanks to the supporters and the, you know, the generous donations and standing orders we've received so far. And we really hope the money is going to keep coming, because I think the thing that really captured my imagination was that this overhaul is different to your regular standard, you know, standard tanks or your Bully Pacifics. So as much as we love them for the whole preservation movement, how often do you get to see a new steam engine? You know, I say that in the sense that, you know, for an engine that hasn't steamed in 75 years, it's missed generations haven't seen this run. There's always that mystery of element, which, you know, what's it going to be like? It's a beautiful engine anyway. So for lots of really interesting reasons, it's capturing lots of people's different imaginations, and we're seeing that in just the interest that we get in the project.
I think that there certainly is a demand for it as well, because, like you say, of that novelty factor. And there are so few working Victorian-styled engines now. We do have a lot of standards, and obviously we're reusing up the remaining life in all of our Barry Scrapyard restorations that were done early on. But there are so few of this kind of style, this sort of beautiful, elegant styling of locomotive.
That's why I think we're really lucky at Swanage, because, you know, we've obviously had the T9 running, we've had the M7 running, and, you know, now we've got the T3. Our USP in the future is hopefully, you know, will be this LSW almost centre of excellence. We've never been able to portray the earliest example of, well, London South Western Rail even, until hopefully the not too distant future. You know, we've got our bullies with Southern locomotives, you know, and to represent the later half, you know, we've got the U-class, the sort of that middle Mornsel, but we don't have anything as early as that. So it's nice that we can always portray the history of the Southern Railway at different points in time.
And I guess with the the Greyhound, the restoration that was done for the celebrations at Waterloo kind of has done a favour to us in the present, because it now means that we are not destroying part of the locomotive's fabric to put it back to original condition, because that was already done. Whereas with something like the T9, it's now obviously got its, you know, superheated boiler and everything. So it looks different to how it was originally built, whereas you don't have that problem with this locomotive.
Yeah, the only real changes were it had a stovepipe instead of a cast chimney, piston tail rods, etc. So even if you wanted to make it suitable for the 30s, it's not the extensive changes like superheated boiler and stuff. Nathan said that 2023 is our aspiration.
And how has COVID affected that?
But we had to put the fundraising on pause because naturally the whole of the Swanage Railway had to focus on survival. So I think, was it about March till about October? The fundraising associated with that was paused while...
And how does that affect your target of 2023 then?
So the target 2023 is actually the latest target. Once COVID was sort of the immediate problems of the pandemic had passed and we completed the Save Our Service appeal on the railway, we then kickstarted the fundraising again for 563. And actually we needed to come out to, you know, reignite people's, you know, interest in the project. And actually, based on the progress that we'd made at that point, and then with the interest, you know, a bit of sort of hope as well. We had to sort of believe that people would come back, they'd start, you know, they'd want to see the engine come back again and start providing their generous donations. So it was a tangible timeline at the time, but also, as you said, with the centenary at the time, 23 would be good for us, because that would be 75 years since the engine last steamed, but then also it would be 175 years since the whole, well, since Waterloo. So that would be, there's lots of nice reasons to go for 23, again, just to capture people's imagination.
Absolutely, yeah.
100th anniversary of the formation of the Southern Railway as well.
So there's lots of reasons.
So the pressure is on for this.
Yeah, it needs a bit of pressure. And yeah, hopefully it'll get easier once people like to back a winner, and the sheer amount of progress we've been able to make this year is visible. You know, beforehand we were still stripping the engine down, we were still, you know, getting the plate work built for the firebox, whereas now hopefully, and, you know, the next milestone for us will be to actually get the engine rewheeled. The progress that we can actually show to our members and supporters now, it makes all the difference. So people really want to back a winner, so actually 23 seems tangible.
And it's a huge mojo boost, isn't it, for everybody involved when they start to see things being put back together? Because obviously the strip down process is really important, but it's also a little bit depressing. And when things are away being machined and stuff, it's very hard to get close up, you know, to get people excited about close up, like pictures of bearings and stuff like that. It's like, yes, I know that horn guides are really interesting, but it's great when you can lift the boiler back into the frames and you can put the wheels back on and everything else like that. So seeing those big milestones, I think, will really aid you in that sense.
I think, yeah, just going back to the COVID thing slightly, we were quite lucky in terms of that 2023 deadline that the trust had already bought the copper for the firebox and it was already being pressed and shaped at the South Devon Railway, and that work continued. It's very expensive, and so we were quite lucky that that process had already started before coronavirus, and it continued.
Yeah, and before, you know, shipping costs escalated so much, and another hidden cost that you don't really think about immediately.
And so although we didn't, for that 6 months we couldn't really do a lot, when we restarted it was like, oh, the firebox has arrived, it's been made.
Super. And then what's after that then?
once the firebox has dropped in, we've had the new the duplex being machined as well. We've had the new angle ring as well manufactured. The boiler we're hoping will be complete within the year, and then we can get that steamed. So that's the steam. Yeah, that's the outer frame steam test done. It'll be a case of dropping it into the frames when they're ready. So yeah, the components, the pieces are coming together. Whilst we need to get the majority, well, we've done the lion's share of the boiler work, but we didn't. You don't want to progress it too quickly because we didn't want it. Yeah, the boiler to be ready and sat there ticking away whilst we were on the frames. So it's it's balancing the sort of making sure that we can have mechanically the engine ready.
Yeah, you really want them to converge, don't you? And you want them to be ready at the same time.
Yeah, they should come at the same time. Yeah, so I say the boiler should be ready within a year. The only other bit, obviously, that we now need to look at and we're focusing over the course of this winter will be the tender.
Well, that's it, isn't it? So this engine, it also has a crucial component that will need to be ready on time, and that's the tender. So what can you tell me about that?
So the tender stayed on the railway. We took the engine to the flour mill in 2017, but the tender's remained with us ever since. We've taken it under storage undercover, which has been great. We opted to go for the engine first, knowing the tender would be the easier task later, get the following and then get the support. And now we launched the tender club.
And what condition is it in? Because I know that a lot of tenders can suffer because they're water carriers, and water and metal don't famously get on very well, and then coal dust as well does its part sometimes. And what kind of condition is the body in?
It's tired. The engine, the tender is like you say, it's a coal cart. It's not particularly complicated. When it arrived, it was slightly damaged when it had was it coming off the lorry with the brake rigging. A lot of it was broken, which is a bit annoying, so we have to replace all that.
Is that where it caught the apex of the angle of the coming off the lorry?
Yeah, we don't really know how it happened, in fairness. It just, some of the brake rigging sort of was damaged during the unloading of the lorry. It's not something we're too concerned about, because obviously we're going to make the engine run, and all of the brake rigging was made of wrought iron, which is really not suitable for using. So we were going to have to make new anyway.
So how much money needs to be spent on the tender?
Between 50,000 and 60,000 pounds on the tender.
That figure depends, obviously, on how much of that work is done by volunteers. And obviously, because we're doing it at Swanage, we should be able to reduce the cost.
It's part of the project that is the first bit that we've been able to sort of say that we intend to use volunteers on it. Our volunteer effort so far has been the behind-the-scenes stuff, whereas the tender is going to be something that we can use our own volunteers on, really crack on with, reduce the costs as much as possible, but we obviously need to have a quality product at the end of it. And obviously the engine still needs, a decent tender, a reliable tender. And so the tender will be going into the works in early 2022 to be started by our team and the team at Hurston Works. There are things that we need to do on it with regards to changing the firing position on it. It's a little bit high up at the moment, quite in Victorian style. In the day-to-day use, it really does need a bit of modification to make it more comfortable for our modern-day crews. You won't be able to see it. If you were looking at the side of the engine, you wouldn't know.
Why was that? Is that because they just didn't think about crew ergonomics, or is that because people were shorter, or what's the reason for that?
Well, if they were shorter, it was higher. if you're a 6 foot person and you're stood there, the firing position is above your hips, which is really, really odd. So it's high.
So it would have been even harder if you're shorter then.
it's not a good... this is where we've kind of made the decision. This is where we have to sort of think about not just the engine's authenticity, but its ease of use going forward. So the engine is quite... The tender is 3,300 gallons of water, and then the coal was literally just a flat on top of the water space, and it just piled up. Now, obviously, we don't need the engine to carry 3,300 gallons of water on the railway. We need it to carry a decent amount of coal and for to be our local crews to be able to use it day to day.
And how long is the Swanage?
It's 6 miles each way, 11 miles if you're going to Wareham.
And I'm guessing that there are opportunities to refill with water when you turn around.
Yeah, I mean the engine would probably do 3 or 4 trips on one refill. What we're going to do is just mod the firing position slightly to give us a more comfortable position for our crews to operate the engine. Because obviously, if we leave it as it is, no one will like to go on it because it'll be so uncomfortable to fire it. It'll be messy. And so this way, we can just do a small modification that no one will see, but we will all benefit. So this is what, this is where you have to take the authenticity very seriously, but also make it attractive for our people who we don't pay to use the engine. We have to make this engine acceptable for crews of the 21st century to use it. And especially now, but you know, obviously the only time this engine has ever run is when it's had paid people operating it, firemen from the Southern Railway, LSWR.
Who do as they're told.
Yes, absolutely. They have a lovely monetary hook to use the engine. Obviously, we don't have that pleasure now. So what we're going to do is just modify the engine slightly to be able to use it more easily every day.
Well, you're absolutely right, though, because if it doesn't get used, then there was no point in the investment in the first place.
Absolutely. We just need to make sure that people want to use it. But the T9 has the same arrangement. This is, if you had a look at the T9's tender, that's what 563's firing position will look like. It won't look out of place. You wouldn't know if you got on the footplate. You wouldn't know it was anything different.
Well, I'm glad we've recorded this now, because that means that anybody building a model of it will have to make a change for the as-preserved condition. And that'll please the rivet counters out there.
I'm quite happy to defend that choice. I mean, some people have been very sort of, some people have said, oh, they don't want to see that done. Well, actually, they're not the ones going to be operating it. And we have to just make sure that the engine is good to operate now and forever. And people will thank us for it. I can promise you.
And so what's the focus of fundraising at the moment?
You know, at all times we are going the whole thing, but the tender is what we are wanting to raise money for at the moment.
And so if somebody wants to contribute to the project, what would you advise that they do? Like, how should they get in touch?
There are three different ways, really. We've got general monthly standing orders of various different amounts, and you get various different benefits, from a lovely 563 badge to a brilliant bit of artwork that one of our supporters, Kevin Williamson, has done, and some original stays out of 563's firebox that were carefully extracted by the flour mill and then machined. My dad, who's also a volunteer at Swanage Railway, and then I've polished them, and then I will post them. So get yourself a nice original bit of...
Nice bit of Victoriana.
Nice for the mantelpiece, a good talking point. Then there's also, as Matt said, for the tender, we launched earlier this year a tender club, so we were after people to donate £500 in 10 monthly payments or in a one-off. We're very grateful that we've raised about £10,000, which is enough for the materials to get started on that project, and that the tender and the locomotive can be ready.
And if there's anybody out there who wants to get stuck in physically, like, what should they do? Is it a case of joining the Swanage Railway?
They can visit the 563 Locomotive Group website. It's 563locomotivegroup.co.uk, and they can make contact with us there. Obviously, start to look at doing the tender, strip down, and so on and so forth. And you can also sign up for our mailing list for our T3 times, which Will collects for us. And then, yeah, we tell members the opportunities that there are to get involved. Visit the flour mill itself from time to time. We can obviously look forward to hearing from you there.
One of the other things I just want to think about was, do you think that restorations such as this will help the image of railway preservation? Because what I was thinking about in preparation for this was, what other Victorian style or even just 440s are out there? Because there's, I mean, Butler Henderson has been and gone. There's the Great Central 567 project, but that's a new build. I was thinking that, do you think that there will be more like this in the future?
The people that are rebuilding the Brighton Atlantic, they want to do a South East Chatham Railway. It's a D or an E class, which is a 440. Obviously, hopefully, we will have a T9 come and join it. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the engines that have been saved of this sort of era are stuffed and mounted, and there's a huge debate about what preservation means. But I think, you know, hopefully with 563, we will show that, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs and whatever people think about whether or not it should have been given to the Swanage Railway, we are going to show a really interesting, a wider audience what a Victorian express passenger locomotive was like, you know. And there's lots of really interesting stories that we can spin off from that. Like, I can't wait until it visits the Severn Valley Railway, hopefully, and we can get it on some teak coaches, recreate the, you know, Dunkirk evacuation troop train, things like that, you know.
And also there's the options for filming as well, because people always want sort of that classic locomotive styling, don't they? When they're setting like a period drama, and they're quite hard to come by, and you get things like a GWR 2800 that's supposed to be in the 1880s or something like that. It doesn't really work. So it would be great to have a one of those truly old style locomotives available for filming work.
Yeah, it's got there's a real Victorian elegance about it. It's just, yeah, the distinctive splashes and the lining, you know, it's you feel the age of it. Yeah, they're wonderful things to look at. Yeah, and even like the stovepipe chimney. You know, it's not often you see that. You know, they went for the lips soon after. You know, I think for what the engine means as well. Short of building a new Adams engine, this is the only Adams tender engine in the land. You know, fortunately, the Isle of Wight have Calborne. You know, there's the B4 and the radial, but that's it for Adams engines. You know, there's nothing else. But the fact that we can make one of the four steam along Calborne, it's exciting for a multitude of reasons. And so whilst new builds are good, don't get me wrong, but we've got so much history associated with this engine. You know, there's a lot to tell from the late 1800s. It's exciting, and it's got all the mystery and all the history to go with it. What's not to like?
I do think it's one of the most elegant sort of steam engines that is around,
Speaking completely without bias, Will.
If you ask someone to draw a steam engine, if they didn't draw Flying Scotsman, they would probably draw something quite a lot like the T3. It's that quintessential Victorian steam express engine. There is a real gap of them working. And so in original condition, because obviously, as you mentioned, the T9 is still a lovely engine, but it's been superheated, so it's not really quite the same.
It's going to be little things as well, even in the detail. At the moment, we're going to be keep retaining the piston tail rods on. Everyone loves seeing the wheels go around, but the fact that you get to see the piston rod extending out the front of the cylinder, it's just little things like that. There's so many exciting little details that we haven't yet been able to show off. We haven't got one whistle, we've got two whistles on this engine as well. So unlike the standard Western whistles, this will be something quite different.
It's brilliant. I mean, we're really looking forward to seeing it again. What is it, do you think, that drives the supporters of this locus specifically? Why would people contribute to this and not something else?
I think that London and the South Western Railway made very elegant locomotives, and the T3 has this kind of aura about it. It's not run for 75 years. It's got this kind of uniqueness about it. There's no one alive who's operated it. That's exciting. We've looked and looked and tried to find people who might have operated it back in the 40s, but there's no one. It's going to be an exciting process, because once we've actually got the engine steaming and running, we're going to have to learn how to operate it, because there's no one who knows how to.
I think it was interesting when we had our socially distanced meeting at the flour mill in end of May for our supporters, and we asked that question, why is everyone here and why are they? And some people were like, I saw the engine at Waterloo 100 in 1948. I thought then that it was a brilliant, express locomotive. And when I saw it was being restored, I just leaped to the opportunity. And then there are others that have a great appreciation for Adams or Victorian engines. There's a real spread, but it's everyone. I think lots of people can't believe that this engine that was sat in the turntable in the NRM 20 years ago, you think, well, that's a lovely engine, but it's just the only place it's going to go is round that turntable, round and round, is suddenly, being restored.
Definitely. And I think that there is a new surge in interest in pre-grouping railways, not just locomotives and stock, but also just styles and different methods of operation and that kind of thing. I think the interest in that is growing as, 1968 gets further away from us.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well, we've been quite lucky we've got a lot of our active volunteers that support us. We all volunteer in the operations department on the footplate at Swanage. And actually prior to us acquiring 563, there's always been a photograph of, it's a different 440 Adams Express locomotive, I think it's an X2, at Swanage. And it's always been there. And I think everyone would always look at it and agree that that's an absolutely lovely locomotive and it's a great thing. And then suddenly we're within a stone's throw of being able to replicate that. And so actually, there's been a really good level of support from the volunteers. This is a sort of engine that used to work down the branch and we'll be able to recreate. So it's great.
It's not just about the engine running. It's about giving a new generation a reason to volunteer on the railway in general. As Swanage Railway Trust members, we always want new volunteers and we want to have new firemen and new drivers. 563 is that carrot. So they might not have contributed to the restoration or been involved physically or financially, but they're going to be running our trains in future. And if 563 helps encourage that, then that's fantastic.
Yeah, no, that's it. I think, you know, internally there's lots of appeal, there's lots of interest because it's something different, it's something new. Externally as well, then, you know, whether you appreciate the history, whether you just want to, you know, understand the technical elements, or just the fairy tale story of 563 is, you know, this greatest survivor of such a long period of time, and some people just want to see, you know, see that dream come true, you know, at the end of it. So I think that's why we get, I think to our advantage, that's why we've had so much support, because there's no one particular reason. We've just had a sort of, you know, plethora of reasons to support the engine, and yeah, it's great. We couldn't be, you know, we're so sort of grateful and humble for the sheer amount of interest and, yeah, the messages and the support that we get, and the donations, the standing orders, just because of what we're doing. And so we'd love to do it for everyone, for preservation, to see the engine through and show it off. You know, we look forward to getting expressions of interest from other railways when it's ready to share it around the country.
How much is left to raise to complete the locomotive in terms of funding?
In terms of funding, we've done the lion's share so far. We're over halfway there, but that's about £250,000. We still have another £250,000 to go, so we're looking at about £500,000 in total.
Mm.
And if we can keep sort of that going and get more funds in, especially now at this sort of crucial stage where, you know, we've got the labour costs of reassembly, the faster we can get that, then the more likely we're able to sort of hit that target of 23 to get the T3 done. So yes, as long as the money is forthcoming, then we can deliver on that.
If people want to see this become a reality and they want to help, then where should they go?
So they can go to 563locomotivegroup.co.uk. There's information about the history, how to donate, T3 Tender Club, and photos as well to whet your appetite.
So it may not be the home straight yet, but the end is in sight for this, and it's tantalisingly close. So Will, Nathan and Matt, good luck with the project. I hope to see it running soon. And thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us. It's been great.